Barbara and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Barbara.
Okay. My sobriety is 5/16/1992. I'm a year of sobriety. And that's a big deal. And I never downplay my birthday ever. I don't take a lot of credit for them, a little bit of credit, because I did have to get up every day and to get back in the middle of AA, which is the soberest, safest place that I've ever found. My home group is the West Portland group, and my sponsor is Julia. She lives over in Vancouver. And those are some of the things that I was told that I probably should have in order to have some semblance of sanity in rooms without Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me almost 2 years to ask someone to be my sponsor. I did the steps with someone who didn't know they were my sponsor. And I just really struggled with following directions. And consequently, for almost 2 years, I was slowly dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wasn't drinking. I was getting crazier. I was getting more comfortable in my skin. I was a little more volatile, which was hard to believe because I was pretty volatile before I came in. And I was not a program of attraction. I remember one time on the way to a meeting, somebody kind of cut me off. Maybe they did. Real or imagined, I think they cut me off. And nobody ever drives the way I think they should. And I threw a complete fit, a honk, and gave the finger, and all those four things that we're so proud of. And as I went to the meeting, they just stayed right ahead of me. And of course, they pulled into the parking lot. It was one of my first opportunities to make a step to amend. And I said, geez, I'm so sorry, you know. And I didn't know the gal. I was like, welcome to my meeting. I mean, don't you want what I have? And it really, you know, it kind of reminded me. And, it was an important thing to realize that, you know, I may be the only example of the Big Book about Alcoholics Anonymous that someone ever is exposed to. And the person that exposed me to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm currently married to, and I dated in college, and we got sober in college, and he really was a program of attraction. He walked this program as it's laid out in his Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of his ability. And I'll tell you something, I was thinking the other day, I don't think I've ever met, up until I was 28 years old, I had never met anyone who was an Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober when I was 28 years old, and I had never met anyone, and I wonder, 15 years more of drinking, would I be alive? Would I have met? I mean, that one person was so important. It was so important what they were doing as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It truly saved my life. I was born in Northern California in 1964. I'm an only child. My father is an admitted alcoholic, and I didn't label him that. He says he is. And my mom is a raging codependent. She's heard my story before, and she said, yeah, that's, I know. That's what I do, to take care of other people, whether they want to be taken care of or not. And, you know, my father and mother were very young when they got married. They got married because I was already in the oven, so to speak. And my dad's disease progressed very slowly, and his father's disease progressed very slowly. We do a lot of wreckage. We take a lot of hostages. We are extremely destructive in our drinking. We're not the kind of alcoholics that just come out of the chute and just, you know, burn fast and come down hard. We just continue to thrive out there and just, you know, climb up people, and it's just, we destroy lives. And that's what I did from the very, very beginning. My experiences, and this is just my story, I feel that I was born alcoholic. And what I mean by that is that from my earliest memory, I was always uncomfortable in my own skin. I always felt different than I always felt on the outside. I was paralyzed with shyness. I had a really, really hard time making non-contact, speaking to people. If people whispered across the room or laughed or, you know, or anything ever, it didn't matter. If I had just come to a place and nobody knew me, if, like, you know, someone was out in the hall right now and they walked by and laughed, I knew they were laughing at me. And I thought, I'll never go there again, you know. And the world can get pretty small, because even though people do come together and communicate and laugh, and it's probably not about me, but I was the center of your universe and my universe. And I was absolutely consumed with self. And it made for a very uncomfortable little girl. I started to become very, very angry, frustrated, volatile. And when I was 16 years old, my parents had just divorced a few years prior. My mom finally had sort of this sense of relief that, the alcoholic's out of the house. My daughter and I can, you know, have a normal life, things can kind of calm down. And she didn't understand the disease of alcoholism. And the fact was that, you know, for me, I came into this world uncomfortable and unsettled with a committee between my ears, and that committee was not out to encourage me to strive and succeed and be of service to you. That committee was saying things that were very negative and very, you know, not productive. And my mom and I went to a wedding, and there was a couple of kids there and a very popular boy that was a year older than me at the reception, and I was so uncomfortable. All I wanted to do was leave. I was upset that the bride was getting a lot of attention. I'm very frustrated by that. And then I was pretty, you know. I wasn't even at the wedding party, and I wanted this kind of attention. And this young man, a bunch of us were in the kitchen. It was at the someone's home. And he was this popular guy named Dennis. He pushed a, I guess they call it pint, I don't know, with a beautiful glass full of this amber-colored liquid. I knew exactly what it was. I grew up around an alcoholic and a lot of parties, and I had had many sips, but I had never had a sufficient amount of this liquid. And, you know, it's interesting, not everybody reaches for alcohol when it's presented to them. I actually, my best friend, when she first was presented alcohol, she said, I don't think so. And then when she finally did drink, she's like, ugh, I don't want any more. She didn't even like, you know, to her, it's a beverage. It's a beverage not worth pursuing any further because it tastes gross. Have you ever had non-flavored pomegranate juice? That's what it was to her. If you haven't tried that, it's disgusting. And that's what it was to her. There was no purpose to drink that. But I saw that, that had been in my life, you know, for 16 years, and I, every fiber of my being said yes. And I took it, and I took a huge swig out of it. My mom was across the room, and I felt it go down. I didn't like the taste initially. That changed over the years. And it literally hit my shoulders, and it shot out my arm, and I physically felt the effects of alcohol. Now, that may happen to a lot of people. I don't know. But what happened next makes me an alcoholic. I looked up, and all of a sudden, I was like, who cares that Dennis is so popular? I'm a popular fan. And you know what? Lots of people were checking me out. In fact, you know what? They're lucky I'm here. And everything changed. I mean, it was a shift. And my mom, at that precise moment, I was getting the gift of sanity from this alcohol, which I've been told that non-alcoholics, they don't get this effect. My mom always says, it makes me a little woozy. What the heck is that? It elates me. Let's go live our lives. Because now I'm at peace. I'm comfortable in my own skin. I can walk amongst the earth people and not feel like, you know, they're all staring at me and that they're all coming together to get me, etc. And my mom saw me go to take another drink out of this beer. Man, a woman can move fast through a crowd. She was on me. She physically grabbed me. She was livid. And my mom is not volatile. She's very calm. She's a very good little Christian gal. And you know, she's just a neat, calm, loving woman, and she was livid because in her mind, for me to drink would mean the risk of me becoming alcoholic. What she didn't know is that I already was alcoholic, and that what I had just done was actually going to save my life for the next 12 years. It saved my sanity. There's no question in my mind, because if I hadn't had that relief, I don't know if I could have made it. You know, it wasn't suicidal, but I was really kind of skirting around the edges of some really dangerous emotions. And puberty was just on me, so who knows where that would have taken me. And alcohol saved my soul, saved my sanity. And she took me home, and on the way home, it was a summer wedding, and I'll never forget. I had never felt summer breeze like that. I had never felt, it was almost spiritual. Everything changed. Everything. And I had the windows down. We never had air conditioning. We never had any money. Something extra. And when we got home, she said, you go to your room. I'm an alcoholic. I love to isolate. Now I'm bugged. Go to my room where my stereo is. Oh, okay. You know? So I went to my room and I put my little headphones on, and there was a group called The Cars, and they had a song called Moving Your Stereo. And it was this neat kind of new thing where it moved from side to side on your headphones. And I had listened to it hundreds of times. You know, I'd go to sleep with my little headphones on. That's why I'm always like, what? Because I, you know, loud music. And I put those on, it was my favorite song, and it was absolute heaven. And I remember thinking, this will happen again. This will happen again. You know, and sure enough, it did. And I spent from that day on, and wherever that was in my 16th year until my 28th year, 12 years, that's all I did. that's all I pursued. If there was a wedding, first thing I wanted to know, is there a host bar? Is there going to be a bar? Is there going to be alcohol in there? If there was a sporting event, are we going to bring alcohol? Is alcohol put there? If there was a concert, did they serve alcohol there? Do I need a precaution? What's going to be going on? If I went and I was a club rat, I loved to go out dancing, I loved to party, I went to caterers, I went to clubs, anywhere there was alcohol, I had like this radar. I was like Doppler bar, you know, like, and I was there. I was always there. And, you know, I went through high school. I had amazing accomplishments for, you know, high school-esque level of accomplishments. And all through those years, with the alcohol available to me as best as I could get a hold of it, I still kept thinking, what's wrong with me? What is wrong with me? And I would achieve certain things, and I would think, this is the answer. And I'd be filled for like 5 minutes. I became head cheerleader, which in high school was like, you know, like a goddess. I mean, you were like the bomb, you know. I only did it because I hated the girl who was running for head cheerleader. I was like, oh, pizza, you know. Also, she didn't even hardly know me, but I didn't want her to be popular. So I became head cheerleader, and immediately they tried to kick me off the squad because I never suited up, never showed up. I just wanted the title. I didn't want to do the work. And that has been sort of the story of my life. I wanted to have a doctorate, but I barely got my bachelor's. You know, I want to have recognition. I want to have praise. I want you to respect me, admire me, but I don't want to have to do the work for it. And then if you don't respect me and admire me for what little I have accomplished, I hate you. I resent you. I plot against you. I actually gain allies, and we talk about you, and we make sure you never have what I think I shouldn't have. And that's, you know, that's not really, does not expand the beauty around you. You don't get really drawn, you know, tells them, you know, no one wants to procreate with you and become sort of an ugly life. And so what I realized in college, I thought, you know, part of the problem is that, if not all of the problem, is origin. Because I've been born in Northern California. I'm a California girl, don't you know? I was born in Fremont, which is in San Francisco. I mean, yeah, whatever. I'm not a survivor. I was born into, you know, quasi-poverty. And, I mean, I'm no big shot, but I used to always tell people I'm a California girl, and I wore Vans tennis shoes, and I always looked like I was heading out to the surfing. I lived in Grant's Pass, you know? And, I mean, it was always sort of this facade of how I wanted you to perceive me. And, in my last year of college, I met this young man who I was currently married to, and he was the single most attractive man I had ever seen, and he was my flavor. That was, you know, like the ideal. And my dad's very attractive, and I always made a promise to myself, very cautiously, I said it out loud to my girlfriend, will never marry a good-looking alcoholic. I will not marry a good-looking man, or not marry an alcoholic, but marriages two shall come together. I will not marry that. And I was smitten. I was so smitten. And this guy was the worst alcoholic I had ever, ever met. I mean, he was a blackout, blubbering, you know, just a pig of a drunk. And he used to come to my apartment, and he would just be wasted at 2, 3 in the morning. And I'm one of those alcoholics. I'm a functioning alcoholic. You know, I go to class. I pay my bills. I, you know, if I say I'm going to be there, I'm there 15 minutes early because I will die. So that I will die for my desire for you to perceive me as something. You know, please perceive me the way that, and I fought so hard for you to believe that this is who I was. And this guy didn't care. His alcoholism had him by the throat, and he was going straight down. And he was 2 years younger than me. And he came to my apartment one morning, and it was like, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning. And then he knocked on it and said, you know what, I told you to never come over when you're drunk. He said, I'm always drunk. Of course, I'm thinking, I'm married. You know, I mean, oh, I like him. I was in love with this guy, but I knew that if I ended up with him, I'd end up being my mother. And so he disappeared for a while, and it turns out that he had gone to treatment, and that this kid had second-stage liver damage, that he was a true later stage alcoholic, and he got sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous 5 days before his 21st birthday. 5 days before his 21st birthday, and he's been drinking since he was about 8 years old. Heavily. I couldn't even find money for candy at that point, but I guess, you know, if you want it, you're going to find it. And he came back to school. It was the last 6 months of my senior year, and we became good friends, and in 6 months, I watched this person, who many people would have said was a waste of air, because he really was not contributing to anyone, he was not a good person, he was very mouthy, he was just giddy. And he started to soften. He was being accountable. People were like saying, "Hey, Chris," you know, acknowledging him and said, "Oh, it was Chris," you know, because when there was a party and Chris would show up, people would leave because we knew the cops were coming because he was wrong. And like I said, it was much later. And so I became very good friends, actual friends with this kid. I graduated college and I moved to California. And I proceeded for the next 5 years to take a life that was full of promise, full of hope, and full of potential. And I nosedived it straight into the mud. I mean, I did nothing with my potential. And I had all my jets firing, let me tell you. I was doing the best I could. And I just could not, I couldn't get off the runway. I just couldn't. And part of it was, you know, I was self-willed and riot. I was self-centered. And I was drinking as often and as much as I could. I was a binge drinker. Because if you drank every single day, you have a problem. I was always trying to, you know, I didn't drink in the morning unless I was really hungover, but you know, everybody did hair at the dog. I mean, I said that to my mom, said, "Hair at the dog? What's that?" You know? Turns out normal people don't even know what that means. We have our own new language. And, you know, and I was, you know, picking out horrible, horrible guys. I ended up picking out a guy that had hair longer than mine, prettier than me, he took longer showers than me, he used nicer hair care products than me, I mean, he was, you know, for all intents and purposes, I was dating a girl, and he was an alcoholic like me, and, you know, but I was the responsible one, so I'd be the driver, and I really was trying to control and enjoy my drinking, which I never identified with until, you know, what happens is your story starts to kind of unfold as you stay sober, and you start thinking, wow, that is me, and that's why my heart breaks when some people come in Alcoholics Anonymous and they're like, nah, you know, contempt, pardon, investigation, prison for me. And I think, wow, you know, good luck to you. I'm not saying that we have the market corner, but we've got a big part of the market corner, you know what I'm saying? This is a stock I would buy if we were stocks. And anyway, this relationship ended up being very volatile, and I used to say I was abused, but I got to tell you, he was just as abused as me. If he kicked me, I kicked him. If he hit me, I hit him. If he slapped me, I slapped him. I'm 5'9", and I've got a temper, and it was just like just these horrible animals at each other all the time. And Chris called me one day, and we had stayed in contact, and he said, "Hey, I'm downstairs. I was at work." And I was like, "Ooh, well, you know, Chris." And he's like, "No, I'm just kidding. I'm at work." And I said, "You, you know." But and I was calling Chris. Yeah, Chris. And I always really liked this guy. But every time I would talk to him, it was like a different person on the other end. And you know, slowly he became an adult. And then he became an adult with conscience. And he became an adult with a conscience and ethics, you know, and values. And I was like, what in the heck is going on here? And what was happening is that this boy was becoming a man. And that's impossible, I think, from my experience, for an alcoholic male to do that, as it is for females to become a woman. It is impossible. There is this inability to mature and grow. And I know because I have it. And I was experiencing this. In hindsight, I can tell you what it is. But at the time, I didn't know, but I liked it. I liked it. I was very attracted to it. And so one time he called me and he said, I'm actually in Southern California. And I was like, oh, you know, let's see each other. And I never cheated on boyfriends, but in the back of my mind, I was like, hello, you know, and I maybe I can hook up with him, and, you know, maybe he's the answer. And so he got out of his dad's car, and I was staying at my friend's house in Laguna Hills to stay overnight with the long-haired girly boyfriend who didn't know, didn't want to pick him off. He's very volatile. And he got out of the car, and I physically felt, and I'm not a romantic, I'm not, but I literally felt like something came down through the middle of my head, like a little lightning bolt or something. And I immediately thought in my head, I'm going to marry him. And I had known this guy at this point for over 6 years. I'm going to marry him. And I have never wanted to get married. I don't own a hope yet. I think why did you I've never wanted children. I'm 43. I don't have children. I'm not saying all those things aren't great. It just was not for me. And because strong women don't do those things, you know. And the reality is that I wasn't a strong woman. I was a terrified little girl. Terrified. And we hung out that day, and we talked and talked, and we did not hook up, if you know what I mean. But he said something to me that changed my life, and it wasn't that profound in hindsight, but at that moment, it struck me, and he said, God, Barb, you deserve to be happy. And I realized I was not happy. And I don't mean, like, unhappy and not having a good day. I mean soul sick, dying, miserable, hopeless. To the extent that the guy that was the doorman at the building I worked in Westwood, almost every day I would come in and he'd say, he's like this 6'6" black man, he's a really tough guy, and but he's really nice, and he'd say, Barbara, you know, I have some friends that could use some extra cash, we'll take that guy out for you. Because I was so miserable and so good at convincing people that it wasn't my fault. Not my fault, you know. And even though the only commonality, the only thing that was consistent through all my misery was Barbara. That's the only thing. So how is it not, you know, it's not my fault, but how am I not having to part in that, you know? Anyway, when Chris said that, I thought, yeah, you know, you're right. And I'm moving to Oregon, you know. So I went home within a week. I had quit my job within less than a month. I had kicked that boyfriend out. I paid off all his debts. I paid off all of his outstanding warrants. I got him an apartment because, by the way, he didn't work. And I moved up to Oregon. And I moved in with Chris. And within less than about a month, the cops had been called on us. And I had tried to jump from the car while he was driving, and I was really in the theater, so got my fight, and he pointed at me, and I said, ooh, you hit me, and I threw across the bed and tumbled, and he was just standing there like, what? And what had happened is that Chris didn't drink, and I thought, someday he will. I mean, who doesn't drink? How do you not drink forever? That's a joke. I mean, that's not even an option. I've never even heard of that, ever. And so I thought, I just won't drink. Because eventually they'll bring me in. And I had never tried to not drink, ever. Because I had never considered that alcohol was a problem. Even though I had done all those things that I swore I'd never do, I had this value system that was like a 10-foot periphery around me. And by the time I got sober, it was on me. I had compromised every one of my values, every one of my beliefs, everything that made me able to be with me was gone. And so it has also eliminated my reflection in the mirror, which was a huge thing for me. I could not look at Barb without being this sick. I was sickened by the woman I had become, the girl I had become. And I moved here and said, I just won't drink. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is that me, an alcoholic, having drank for 12 years, being 28 years old from a line of purebred drunks, I can't function without alcohol. I tell you what, even if I just know there's a promise of alcohol at the end of the day, I can have a good day, you know? If I know there's a party on a Saturday and I'm having a rough day Friday, I can have a good day because there's a promise of that relief and that ease and comfort that comes from alcohol for me. And he said, and so, you know, what happened was I didn't drink, and within a very short period of time, I was more miserable, more insane, and more volatile than I had ever been. And it was about 3 or 4 in the morning, and Chris and I had a horrible fight. He ate the rest of a giant Hershey bar, because what had happened is that I was grabbing for anything, and I was eating huge amounts of Häagen-Dazs, chocolate chip cookie dough, which I didn't even like ice cream. And these giant Hershey bars, and you see that they're huge. You could surf on them. They're huge. And I was eating them, and it wasn't like I was eating them, oh, this is fun, this is enjoyable. I was eating them like my life depended on it, because I was actually getting a little bit of relief from that sugar, I guess. And it was like 3 or 3 in the morning, and of course this guy's looking at me like, God, you're a real catch, Dad. You know, boy, I'm glad I asked you to marry me. And because he had, you know, eaten the rest of my Hershey bar and threw a fit. And he said, if you were to drink again, what would you do? And I said, oh, I'd go down to Santa Fe, this is over in Northwest, and I'd have a double shot for a bowl with a beer back, and head to the Mission Theater, and I'd get a pitcher of dark beer, and, you know, and then you would go from there, which isn't a lot of alcohol, but that's a good beginning. And I certainly wouldn't have gone in there without drinking first, because how do you actually go into an establishment getting it sober? I don't even know how to do that. So pre-function was the story of my life. And he kind of quiet. Bear in mind, 5.5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, he has no idea that he has just gotten engaged to a practicing alcoholic. Because compared to him, it didn't look like there was a high. I never had a DUI. I was not a blackout drinker, a lot of brownouts, real brown, real murky. But I was a puker, big puker, you know. And I have a lot of hair, as you can imagine, visualized. And it was not pretty. And I was not a lady when that happened. And he said, what would your mom do if she was to give up drinking and drink again? My mom is not alcoholic. First of all, why would she quit drinking? You know, swear off something that, you know, like me swearing off orange juice, which I haven't drank in like 3 years, you know. And I said, well, I guess, if, you know, she'd have a grasshopper, which is some green, nasty, frothy drink that she always orders that is disgusting, smell it across the room, and it evaporates faster than she drinks it, which makes me crazy. And he said, oh, he said, what would your dad do? My dad's an admitted alcoholic, my dad is, my dad loves to drink, and I said, I guess he'd go down to Santa Fe and have a double shot of gold with a beer back, and then he'd go, and I stopped short. And I had the greatest gift that I have ever been given, probably, and that was a moment of clarity. And I looked at Chris, and I said, oh my God, am I an alcoholic? Because it had never occurred to me, because an alcoholic had to look like the problem alcoholic in my life, which is my father, which was the one thing I was never going to do, never. And I wasn't like my father. I was like Barb. And Barb's alcoholism was actually more tragic and more horrific and more saddening than a father's. You know, when my dad was 28, he was nowhere near as ravaged as I was. He had not made nearly the mistakes I made. He hadn't compromised himself as much. His disease progressed slowly. And he was married and a child and whatever. And Chris said something that was a great gift. He said, I can't tell you that it's a self-diagnosed disease. You're going to have to make that decision for yourself. And he said, but you could call the hotline and you know, talk to another alcoholic. And I called the Portland area hotline, and there was another person at the other end. Thank God for that. Thank God. And it was it sounded like an elderly man. And I would say, he's probably my age, 43. You know, he's an older, mature person. And I was 28. Everyone sounded more mature. And I said, you know, I wouldn't want to call him, but, you know, and I'm just, yeah, spewing out all this information. And you know how men are, they're just kind of quiet. They don't mind if there's a pregnant pause. And he said, he just listened, and he said, what is it that you want to do, sweetheart? And I said, I need a drink. Because I could not fathom one more minute without alcohol. I couldn't even make a decision. I didn't even know the left, the right, up or down. I was insane at that moment. Insane. And I guarantee you, if I could have had a six-pack, I would have gotten some clarity. And I'm not saying that, but the problem is that a six-pack takes me to a decent place, and my brain says, well, then how about a half run? And then it says, you know, it comes a case for a reason, and I just go off. And then next thing you know, I've spent all my money, and I've done things that I'm not proud of, and I've thrown up one more time, and, you know, and I've driven drunk, and I've jeopardized your family and you know, my freedom, and every single time. Every single time I drink, every single time, and this is my experience, I always make these promises. I'm going to be the driver. I'm going to be the driver. Because people always say, you haven't even drunk. And I think, oh, okay. And I get in the car, and like 15 minutes later, I was wasted without having any alcohol in me. And that is alcoholism. And now I was actually withdrawn. My body was, I would actually get drunk as I was furthering myself from the alcohol. When alcohol was in me, I actually was very functioning. And actually, if you could just drink and drive, I guess is what I'm saying, that would be the solution. But they don't tolerate that very well. And so I called that man, and he said, I suggest that you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous right now. And it was very, it was like, you know, 4 in the morning or something. Of course, there was nothing right now. But he meant, you know, as soon as possible. So the next morning, I went up to the Alamo Club, and, you know, whether, I don't know. I've been to a lot of meetings there. There's a lot of blurring, a singleness of purpose. There's been lots of meetings have that, and that's a shame because, honest to God, if I'd gone to a meeting that would have talked about anything except alcohol and alcoholism, I wouldn't be here right now. There's no way. Because I don't identify with shooting back. You know, it's not to say I don't wish that I could have gone there because that seemed like a solution, but there's needles involved, and so I wasn't willing to do that. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and after a day or a while, I thought, God, I have to use drugs in order to qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous. So what I did? I stopped one of those meetings. I got to find where I identify. And I don't know why, but that day, every single person in there identified themselves as an alcoholic. Every single person in that meeting. And every one of them shared what it was like, what happened, what it was like now. And they saved my life. They absolutely did. I heard them share out loud what I had in my head and could not articulate and dared not look at, you know, my whole life. And I thought, oh my God. And for the first time in my life, I knew I found my people. I mean, I honestly felt a part of. And it scared me. It gave me peace. It was, you know, just a plethora of emotions. And, you know, I went back the next day, and I kept going to meetings. I didn't share for 2 years in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I said, the shyness did not lift. And I used to sit and I used to look at the promises, and sometimes I think that those should probably be pulled out of the book or the wall, you know, because it doesn't have anything explaining. You know, I was like, oh, those promises, you know, it was like, you know, why don't you make some amends? You know, why don't you take up a little of your crap? And, you know, I want these. But what happened is that I went to enough meetings, and someone said, you know, keep coming back until you hear your story. And I thought, no one's got my story. First of all, it's boring. I'm really a run-of-the-mill drunk. Nothing exciting happened. There's no jail time. There's no DUI. There's nothing exciting about my alcoholism. And that, you know, is what most alcoholics are. It's just a slow, tedious walk to the end. That's most alcoholics. It's nothing really exciting. Most people that share from the podium have a lot of bright lights and excitement, but most of us that sit in the room are just alcoholics. It's dying slow, sick, pathetic death. Wasting our one precious life, just wasting it. And without any fight, because you can't will yourself to not be alcoholic. If you like me and say, I will not be a girl, you know, that's hopeless. That's not going to happen. So, you know, I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. For many years, I struggled with meetings that did not honor the primary purpose, the singleness of purpose, and I, like I said, I almost died in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, stone cold sober. I never considered suicide until I got sober. Ever. Never even occurred to me. I thought suicide was for weak people. And the reality is that suicide, for me as an alcoholic, is for me when I'm not doing the deal. If I'm not right in the middle of the herd, then I'm out on the periphery. When I'm on the periphery, I am really risking my life. And, you know, when you equate that to a pack of caribou and you put them up in Alaska, it's the crazy, sick, stupid ones that are on the periphery. And if you're on the periphery, you're going to get picked off. That's what the wolves eat. And for me, the wolves, that's my alcoholism. That's my old friends, my old haunts, my old habits. And, you know, at 2 years sober, my husband came to me and told me that he had done some extracurricular activity in the marriage. And it was the one thing he swore he'd never do. He swore he would never do, because my dad was horrible adulterer. He was just a womanizer. And he just destroyed my mother's heart. He destroyed our lives, you know, by those actions. And you know, my husband stopped. He got the wife, he got the girl that he'd always loved in college. And all of a sudden, you know, things were kind of good. He had a good job, and he kind of slowed down on the meetings and wasn't calling sponsors much. And, you know, I mean, I got it now. See, isn't that what it's all about? It's about the goal, the end result. And the reality for, you know, an alcoholic of my type, and certainly his type from what he shared with me, is that, you know, this is a daily reprieve. A daily reprieve. Alcoholism is not something that I can say today, all right, I got all my ducks in a row. Now I can go live my life like a non-alcoholic. That is not possible. Because I've seen people do it over and over and over again. And you get those calls 4 years later, and they're like, my world blew up. Really? What a surprise. You know? It'd be like a diabetic saying, well, I'm feeling good. No more insulin injections. You know? That's insanity. It's absolute insanity. It's the same thing. I have a terminal progressive disease. It is on me. It is part of me. It is not curable. It is not curable. And the only solution that I have for it is this program for me. And I've tried all sorts of other things, and crystals and men and religion, and I'm not saying any of that stuff isn't a solution. It wasn't for me. It was not a long-term solution. Especially crystals, whatever. So, you know, he came to me with this information because he had actually talked to his sponsor, he had a new sponsor, and everything was quite ugly, as it would be if some person's carrying a secret like that. We are, if you are a secret, at least I am. And I had two choices. One, the thing that I always swore if it happened, I would be justified in drinking, and it just happened. I had my excuse. And would any of you blame me if I drank? How can you walk through that? The love of your life. We call each other cellmates because we're in it for life, you know? Ooh, we're so good. And he's my best friend. I adore him. We've walked through fire together. But he's human. And he's alcoholic. And thank God he didn't drink. But I was devastated. And I thought, I'm going to drink. This is my excuse. Oh, I got a meeting tonight. So I went to a meeting, and I had just gotten an actual sponsor who I was actually calling, just like 3 days before. And I went to that meeting, and during the setup tradition, halfway through, I said, F it. This is too painful. I can't sit here. Everybody's just happy. And it seems to good for them, you know. And I mean, at 2 years sober. And because nothing had changed, I had done nothing except the steps. I had just enough relief that I hadn't drank. But there was nothing that changed. I hadn't matured. I was not giving it away. I wasn't sponsoring. I made coffee. I mean, you know, that's a nice service as far as it can take you, but at some point, man, you got to give away to a breathing thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, I went to the bathroom, and I was going to go from the bathroom to my car, and that was it. And I didn't know if I was going to drink or kill myself or kill him. Probably kill him. You wouldn't be telling a homicide approach. And she came in the bathroom. She followed me in there, and she said, Barbara, what is wrong? And I went, ugh. And I told her, and she grabbed me. And I'll tell you what, if it would have been a person passing me in the hall that was just a church member, I think it would have been, I would have been unaffected. If my own mother would have walked through the door, it would have been the same. But this woman knew what I was feeling. She was an alcoholic. We were alive. And she enveloped me and said, big giant breath. Wonderful. And she just wrapped herself around me, and in her hand, she was still sober. And God bless her. She said, honey, we're going to walk through this. It's going to be okay. I mean, that was solid. And she said, come back in the meeting. I'm not letting you go. And once again, God saved my life. Saved my life. I don't know if it was a life worth saving, but why not? You know, I mean, is anyone any better than anyone else? And that was when I started doing the 10th step, when I started really trying to work on the 11th step, when I started to do the 12th step, and I started to sponsor, I started raising my hand, I started sharing in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to say, how many teams do I volunteer? That's not my decision. That is not my decision. How do I know what you guys need to hear? How do I know that the person in the back who's dying from this disease, who has never raised their hand, came in late, who decided, you know what, after this, I'm going to go get my shotgun, and that's it. How do I know that what I say might not be that one thing that keeps that person one more day on the planet so that they can just get one more day closer to the center of the path? One more day. You know, it's not my decision. So I stayed in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I upped my meetings. I started going to four or five meetings a week. I was doing two before that, which is just, God, that's like taking two showers a week, you know? It's the middle of August, man. It works, but it doesn't work well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I recommitted myself to Alcoholics Anonymous. I recommitted myself to you guys. And strangely enough, my life just took off. And I don't mean I didn't get a good job. I hardly worked at all in recovery in a real job. I own a CD store, and I'm an artist, and I make jewelry, and I teach both in piano and all those things. I'm one of those creative people. And I have a degree in elementary education. I don't like children, so that's the best. I just stayed in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, this is the only place that I have ever felt part of anything. And you know, when I was probably about just before I turned 10 years sober, I started not feeling very well. I fell down flight of stairs at my house on my 38th birthday, trying to feed my dog. Still cold sober. First time I ever fell down stairs in my life, cold sober. I would have preferred to be drunk because it hurt. And I mean, I went down to the bottom, and both the dogs, the big hunting dogs, showed sort of pointers, and they were like, they froze because I went, pooch, pooch, pooch. And I crushed my sciatica, and I crushed the back of my arm, and I just was like, whoa, it was a heck of a fall. And about 3 weeks later, I started getting really dizzy, just super nauseous, and my vision started kind of sparking and out. And I started to have this horrible fatigue, and for 3.5 years, I got sicker and sicker and sicker. I went to every single doctor you can imagine, and they're always so shocked. I'm like, I'm not looking for pain meds. I'm looking for an answer, you know? And finally, I said, screw it. I'm going to have to live most of my life on my hands and knees, which is a good place to be for an alcoholic. Why not, you know? And I was doing prayer. It helped me kind of strengthen up my meditation because I couldn't get any relief, and I knew that something was very, very, very wrong with me. And after about a year, it was 3.5 years in, I hadn't been to a doctor in a year. I went for my yearly exam, and I said to my doctor, said, my hands still are very numb, and I'm still really, really sick. And this was a woman that said, well, I think I'll just prescribe you Paxil. You still won't feel well, but at least you won't care. That was the solution. And at the top of my chart, it says recovering alcoholic. Yeah. I made her write it there because the most important thing in my life is my recovery. Because without that, I have no husband. I have no friendships, no family, no joy, no life, nothing, no purpose, nothing. That may sound extreme, but it's true. And And I said, okay, I mean, I wasn't away, and I'm not saying whatever, and I'm not having a judgment. It's just that you'll still feel sick, but you won't care. That's not a solution. Yeah. I'm sorry you have a compound fracture here with a Band-Aid, and that's not a solution. That doesn't work for me. And I went out in the waiting room, and I read the small print, and I thought, you couldn't force me with a gun in my head to take this. I'm telling you right now, this, it scared me, because it talked about psychosis. Withdrawal and psychosis, and I thought, girlfriend, I'm already there. Something in me to heighten the possibilities of a break. And so she said, well, maybe we'll just send you to the neurologist one more time. And I went to the neurologist, and of course, I had lesions, I had multiple sclerosis. I'm sick. I'm real sick. And, I was like, well, there was relief, like with the alcoholism, and then the work began. And then the work began one more time. And I thought, didn't I get handed my big bum rap by being alcoholic? Wasn't that the big kahuna? Well, what about that thing that happened with me and my husband? Wasn't that the big thing? And you know, it turns out life is infection, man. It wasn't like something I signed up for that said, all of our little things over and life will be grand. You know, that's nowhere. I looked in the first 164 pages, and this is life. It comes at you at point blank range. You know, and if I hadn't been right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have no idea. Because I'm telling you right now, I thought I knew what suicidal thoughts were. Oh, heck no. I had no idea. Because they said, oh, by the way, the treatment is a daily injection. And I thought, oh, delightful. The one thing that I swore I'd never be was an IV drug user. And now every night I get to inject myself. Not mind or mood altering. They don't know why it works. It's like I'm injecting water, except that it costs, $40,000 a year, but I have insurance. Wouldn't that be the greatest scam? It's a placebo. Ha ha, you've been injecting water. And I'm sure they're watching me for little cameras in the engine. But I do that, and I've been doing that for almost 2 years, and the disease has slowed down, and I don't have any extra lesions. Which is just plaque in the brain of the deal, except it's dead spot. It's a lot of fun. And so far, so good, your name or something. I never could remember before. I didn't know. Yeah, I have an excuse. But, I'll tell you right now. How much time do I have?
We go till 45, so okay. I just want to make sure.
Whenever you're done.
Okay.
Well, okay. For those of you who have the PC, I'm all done. I tell you right now that when I signed up for Alcoholics Anonymous, first of all, I didn't sign up for it. When I showed up, I wasn't a skeptic. I didn't know anything about AA. There was hardly even any movies that I'd seen. I hadn't seen Days of Wine and Roses. I hadn't seen why would I see those things? Boring, that's not cool. I came into these rooms, I had absolutely no expectations. Then I got huge expectations. Then I got righteous and thought, you should have expectations. And let me tell you what those should be. I went through all those phases. And what I was experiencing, I think, was the pains of growing up. I was growing up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was becoming a woman. The very thing that the earth people expect from you, I was doing in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And finally, my natal age, my maturity was catching up with who I was. And, I'm not saying that I'm any example of maturity, or anything like that, but I can tell you that I walk amongst the planet a free woman. I am completely free. I can walk by a bar and catch a waft of beer. And yeah, I think, hello, because I love beer and tequila. That's my best friend. But I absolutely know that I can't go there. I cannot go there. And I can't will myself to not go there. I have a reprieve. And it is, this morning I rolled out of bed and hit my knees. I asked God, maybe it serves, keep me sober, all the things. I asked for my assignment, and I mean it. Please don't make it too hard. I really sincerely am of service and want to be of service. And then I pause and I meditate and I don't burn candles or do those, and if you do, that's great. Who cares? My practice is my practice. How I connect with God, how I talk and listen to my power that's greater than me is my own business. And I only share these things because, first of all, tonight, the one person that will leave here with an absolute delightful feeling of purpose and joy is me. I don't do this because, there's a free toaster in it or, anything like that. I do this because this is the only thing that I've ever experienced that is absolutely not equivalent to, but better than drinking. That's the real deal. And, I can tell you that, if you're new to these rooms or you're in these rooms and anything's lacking in your recovery, it's sort of like the tide, man. It now comes in, it goes out, comes in, it goes out. It's not really very predictable for me. It's just this journey. And I've lost my expectations, and I can honestly say, I've heard people say, oh, what a bunch of hooey when people with a little bit of sobriety say they don't know anything. I'm telling you right now, I don't know anything. And when my sponsors say, well, what do you think? And I think, oh, you're coming to an idiot. You have questions about your life and all this stuff. And I mean that. You know, I barely can keep my own tail hooked onto the back of me. I am an alcoholic who is sobering Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a counselor, higher power, or a mother. None of them say. And that is not what I'm here for. I simply share my experience, strength, and hope. And if someone identifies, then maybe they can experience what I experienced almost 15 years ago. An absolute connection. A connection for the first time in my life. So, thank you guys for letting me do a service. And it's great. I'm glad that it was a small crowd. It's a lot easier.
Thank you.
All right. So, since we have, like, some time, I'm going to ask Barb. And please, if you're good, call on, come up to the podium and...